From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Mike Waters, and this is Options. Anthropologist Margaret Mead has been writing about the customs and practices of faraway places since 1928, when her first book was published. That was Coming of Age in Samoa. In recent years, Margaret Mead has focused her attention on changes in our culture, and she spoke of these changes in April at Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois. Her remarks were recorded by public station WCBU, Peoria, Illinois. Dr. Mead.
Now, what I want to talk about today is the question of where this student generation stands in reference to the earlier generations that you have to cope with, that you have to cope with as your older brothers and sisters and friends, as your parents, as your grandparents, as your professors. You know, they all represented some kind of generation or other. It's still around. Plus the mass media who tell you who you are, what you think, whether you have any interest in anything. At present, they know you're all apathetic. You're totally apathetic. You're interested in nothing. You're a little bit like the 50s, but not really like the 50s yet, because there are no panty raids. But they're waiting. You've, on the whole, given up drugs and taken up drinking again, and that makes your parents very happy, because... You know, they all went around 10 years ago saying, you know, we know alcohol. They do indeed. And better the drug you know than the drug you don't know. Well, they've got it now. And alcohol's back, and on the whole, drugs aren't very popular anymore, and they aren't very smart. And they do. And, of course, you're studying now. The only reason you're studying is because jobs are hard to get. If jobs were easy to get, you wouldn't be studying. But now that you discover that jobs are hard to get, you're facing reality, and you realize you might have to go do some work. Not much, but some. And you don't care about any issues at all anymore. Not a thing. There's no political interest on college campuses. There's no student movement in favor of any political candidate. In fact, at the present time, the only people that are interested in the election are the candidates. As nearly as I can see, there's practically nobody else at all. I mean, each candidate has a little entourage, and they don't even stick with them. In New York State, all the people who had worked for one candidate got fired because he made a deal with another candidate to get his delegation. So there's no interest in politics on campuses anymore. The student groups that had arranged 3 or 4 years ago to have a checkoff from their student dues for Ralph Nader's association, today you find little closed up offices with a few things stuck under the door. And this is what you're being told. You know, you can decide whether it's true or not, but this is what the media tell you. And you're rather nostalgic, and you like to play a few tunes from the 50s. And there's a new rumor now, I hope everybody's heard this, that the Beatles are coming back. And they're going to be paid, the rumor is, they're going to be paid $50 million to give a worldwide reappearance of the Beatles, and then we'll really be back in heaven. Now, it's very important what you're being told when you're in college, what you think about yourselves, what's going on in the rest of the world, because you'll never have as good a time again to do a little thinking, to decide where you are, and to make a first go at where you want to be. Now, if I'd been talking to you 50 years ago, I would have been saying, of course, you have to pick your life work. And this is very, very crucial, because the decision you make now will bind the rest of your life. That isn't true anymore. The decision you make now may last for 5 years or 10. And you may be asked to make 4 or 5 other decisions in the course of your life. And your chances of living a long, long, long time are very good. So instead of preparing for an early death, you have to prepare for a terribly long life. But One thing that has remained reasonably constant as far as university or college life is concerned, that it is a time when you can do some thinking. It's a time when you can do more talking than you'll ever do again, probably. You don't care about sleep, and you can sit up all night and discuss things, and you've got away from your families, and you don't go home oftener than every weekend, and in between you can do a little thinking on your own. So that what happens in these 4 years matters, and matters in a rather different way than the way it affects the rest of the country. Now, one of the things we've been trying to do with the bicentennial, there's been a big project called Kin and Community, and all over the country people have been encouraged to go back and dig out their family histories. And they've been digging out all kinds of things. Some have dug out 6 or 7 generations. Some have dug up a lot of home movies and fascinating pictures of your grandmother being lifted off the ground by your grandfather, taken in a photographic studio, or where she was being perched on a bunking bronco in a studio or something. And people are getting very good, interesting sense of what their background was like. A lot of them are interviewing their grandparents, and we now have people make up books the way they used to make up baby books. You know, in your baby book, you say, how much did the baby weigh, and when did it get its first tooth, and what was its first word? And you have a little piece of poetry that says, where did you come from, baby dear? Well, now people are making books to interview their grandparents, and they find out where grandfather was born, who his parents were, and where he went to school, and where he is now, and so forth. And this is spreading all over the country. It's gone pretty well. And a lot of people have found it fascinating to interview their grandparents. And a lot of grandparents that claimed that their children would never listen, that they couldn't get them to talk, that they didn't want to hear them. When the kids come along and sit down and say, you know, I've got an assignment in school, will you help me? The grandparents who've been dying to talk all the time talk at great length. And so that we've, in this bicentennial period, we've really done reasonably well in giving people a way of learning a little bit more about the past than they'd known before, and not being quite as alienated from the past as they were before. But we found quite a few young people who either couldn't find any grandparents, they'd moved to another city, they didn't know any old people at all anywhere, and who didn't want to do this sort of thing. And so we suggested to them, well, how about writing something for your grandson? Now, if you sit down and think about it for a moment, and you're writing for your grandson, what would you tell them? What would you tell them about yourselves now that might be of interest to them when they were born? There's quite an amusing book by Ralph Bloom called Old Glory and the Real-Time Freaks, which was written by as if a 17-year-old boy was telling his grandson about his grandfather. And Ralph Bloom had suggested the idea that the real living link is from grandson, grandfather to grandson to grandson's grandson, because that boy in the middle or girl in the middle can go back and forward. I've seen my grandmother, and I can tell my granddaughter what she was like. That's the usual measure, is 5 generations. And we find a lot of people who don't know anything about their past and haven't any way of getting at it in a way that makes sense to them, who would like instead to think about the future, at least to think about the present in terms of the future. But when they start to do this, we come up against the fact of how very difficult it is at present for most students to visualize what the world will be like when their grandchildren are in college, say. And you can try the exercise when you leave. Don't do it now or your minds will wander. But you can try it later and see what it's like to try to think ahead and what you're thinking ahead to. And when you try this, you discover that most of you don't believe in the future. That most of you don't really have much idea where the future is. And none of you practically are doing anything about it to see there is a future. because the future of the world at present is in reasonable danger. And the thing that is most characteristic of this generation is they're living in the present and the next 5 years after you get out of college, what kind of job you might be able to get. But that the future beyond 4 or 5 years ahead is pretty dim at present. Some people are reading statements by Garrett Hardin that we ought to have triage and just let, you know, 2 billion people die so we'd survive, which is not an ethic that we can possibly subscribe to. Other people are worrying about the state of the nuclear proliferation of weapons and know that if we let the plutonium economy go, we are spreading incredible danger over the entire world, and the little bit of safety that we build up by deterrence will disappear. Some people are worrying about the energy crisis in the United States and that we might have to lower our standard of living and make great sacrifices. And usually the people that are saying this are not talking about themselves, but that their neighbors are the kind of people that wouldn't make any sacrifices. So, of course, they would, but those dreadful other people that live down the road wouldn't. So what will we do if we have to make terrible sacrifices? And most of the terrible sacrifices that are being discussed are possibly having one car instead of three, giving up eating the kind of beefsteak that is based on feeding food that's needed for people to animals so as to produce a kind of steak that will give you a heart attack, which I don't feel is a great sacrifice somehow. Replanting our towns so the people live closer together and public transport will work again, and we have diverse communities where there are old people and young people and middle-aged people living somewhere near each other, and where people learn something about being people again instead of this great proliferation of suburbs over the United States, which, of course, though I understand this, there may be some people here from Chicago, and they may have seen the suburb and know what it was like, all of which has developed since World War II. So there are people who talk about lowering our standard of living, where actually every proposal is being made seriously and not extremely for a change in lifestyle, are proposing things that people lived with quite comfortably 30 years ago and weren't suffering. We've doubled our consumption of meat in the last 20 years. For what? For nothing. We're living at a style that is so excessively wasteful that very tiny changes in what we do would save millions and millions of lives. So that there are a lot of statements all around about what's happening, but on the whole, things haven't gelled yet. And on the whole, I think most students today are, I don't know exactly whether one should say, waiting there, you're poised somewhere, and you don't know where you are exactly. I mean, well, you are studying quite a bit, and a lot compared with the 1960s. Now, one of the other problems that students are facing today is that everybody compares you to the 1960s. And nobody can remember earlier, on the whole. And in the 1960s, as I heard one student say recently, you know, we had riots and everything. 1960s, some things really happened. The 1960s, life was exciting. 1960s, people cared. 1960s, students were all concerned with everything, and then the New York Times writes articles saying they've all moved to the suburbs and aren't paying any attention. Which isn't true. They haven't moved to the suburbs. They moved into the medical profession and into the legal profession and into Washington. They've been making just as much trouble there as they were before. It's a great mistake to say they all moved to the suburbs. Few people who were making a lot of money being revolutionaries are now making a lot of money writing about not being revolutionaries. But that's like getting the Beatles back. It isn't the really relevant thing. But the thing that has changed between the 60s and now, the important thing, is that in the mid-60s, when the students got to college, this was the first group who'd grown up in the post-World War II world. The first group who'd grown up in a world where the bomb was a commonplace. not a new event, where we were going into space, and it wasn't science fiction, but it was real. The first group who grew up in a world where we'd explored every piece of it, we knew where everybody was. For the first time, we knew that the things that the great religious leaders had said about the unity of mankind and the things that anthropologists had been saying as matters of faith were so. That there was nobody on this planet but Homo sap. Not nobody at all. Nobody here but us. And then as we began going into space, we discovered there wasn't anybody else in the solar system either. And we were all here all alone. We'd explored this planet. We'd found we were the only people on it. We were the only people we could depend on. We were the only brains we could depend on. Somebody wasn't going to come from Mars and fly around in a spaceship and say, behave, which is what everybody hoped in the 50s. And that we were here. We were all alone. We had the power to destroy this planet. The population had gotten completely out of hand. We were wrecking the environment, hand over fist, using up irreplaceable resources and doing irreparable damage. You just have to go out the road that I just traveled from Macomb to watch it happening again as the farmers are plowing. A cloud of dust is going up and making a dust bowl again, just as we did in the 30s, as if we hadn't learned one solitary thing. Now, when that first group of who got to college in the 60s were appalled because they came with fresh eyes. My generation and the generation after mine had gotten used to these things gradually, one at a time. And we belonged in another world. We were like people who'd come from an old country into a new. We were immigrants in time, the way our ancestors were immigrants in space. But the kids who got here in the 60s just took a look and said, this is awful. What do you think you're doing? And being the children of the post-World War II world, they were the children of electricity. You know, they'd all their lives, they'd pushed buttons and got what they wanted. And if you look at the history of light, as anthropologists do, because we work with people who still make fire with a fire plow, or carry fire and never make it at all if they can possibly help it because it's so hard to make, you get some idea of what electricity has meant to the human race and how it's changed our whole view of everything. To be able to get light at once, when in the past the best you could do was maybe work for 10 minutes to get some light, and then if the tinder was wet, you didn't get it at all. And the one I've worked in places where the only source of light would either an open wood fire, which doesn't carry very far, or a bunch of coconut leaves, which doesn't carry very far either. And the dark was terribly dangerous and terribly frightening. And light was the one little pinpoint in the darkness. And yet, now we had a generation where almost everybody had electricity, everybody that counted practically. The fact that they'd gone camping in the summer didn't mean anything. That was play. And most of the camps had electricity. They'd all grown up with a belief that you pressed a button and you got what you wanted, so they tried it. They said everything ought to be fixed tomorrow morning. And this was almost unprecedented on American college campuses. And I think this is an important thing for students to realize, that in this country, colleges are not the seat of political action unless there's a real crisis. When there's a big crisis, students get interested temporarily. And they may go out and demonstrate or get. I remember when Sacco and Vanzetti were going to be executed, and I was the editor of the college paper at the time of the Sacco and Vanzetti trials. And our dean, who was very active in international affairs, she was a leader in international affairs, and she'd been away for 6 months, and she came back and discovered that in the college paper we had dared to write an essay about the Sacco and Vanzetti case. So she sent for my business manager, whom she thought was a little more amenable than me, probably. And she said she didn't know who Mr. Sacco and Vanzetti were, but she assumed they were not Barnard persons. And we should only be writing about people that were Barnard persons. Well, we, and the, actually, the things that we'd written, I mean, I think my college roommate, I was the associate editor, my roommate was the editor of the story I'm going to tell you now, had written, was called up, cheer up, Mr. Coolidge. It was Mr. Coolidge, who was then our vice president, had written an article called Are the Reds Stalking Our College Women? And you know what? His big evidence was that Frieda Kirschway, who then edited The Nation, had said that a girl couldn't get through Vassar without knowing what socialism was. It was dreadful, frightful. And so she'd written the article calling Cheer Up Mr. Coolidge, pointing out that we'd had a mass meeting, but nobody had come. Which was, and even in the, at the periods of the height of pacifism among students at the end of the 30s, just before World War II, there were very small groups of people who were involved. And on, by and large, American and English college students go to college and continue their innocence and youth and play games and study a little and don't get very well involved in community life until they have children. That's been the usual rule. Now, when they're not going to have children, we have to figure out something else for them to do. But in the past, they got interested when their children went to school. And then we got active participation as citizens from the time you had a child until the time the last one left school. At which point, everybody resigns from citizenship, goes to Florida, and comes back and votes against the bond issue. And this was the style of American life, so that the mid-60s were unusual. And it's important to realize that they were unusual, that they marked the recognition of the big generation gap between the people who grew up before the mid-40s and the people who grew up afterwards, which is a gap that goes right around the world. It's just as strong in Pekin or in Moscow or in Calcutta or in Papua New Guinea as it is here. The gap between all the people who grew up before that period and all the people that grew up afterwards. And at that point, there were no adults anywhere in the world who had grown up who were in the same period as kids had. There wasn't anybody they could talk to. There wasn't anybody they could look at who they were ever going to be. And for the older generation, we had to look at the kids and say, you know, there'll never be anybody like us again. And, you know, the thing that's kept adults going for 100,000 years is producing little replicas of themselves. And to discover, to realize that there were never again going to be anybody like us was tough. And it was tougher for the kids, you know. And in the past, as a man could say, an older man could say to a young man, I have been young, but you have never been old. And the end of that is shut up. But then, beginning in the mid-1960s, the kids could say, you've never been young in the world I grew up in, and you don't know what it's about. Now, a lot of people misinterpreted this when one pointed it out, saying that one should... They said, I said, that the children should teach their parents and kids should rule the world, which I never said at all. What I said was that the young people asked questions from a different point of view from their elders. They saw things with new eyes, and they could ask new questions. And unless the elders took the trouble to find out the way the young people saw things, they couldn't talk to them and they couldn't teach them. And we saw that demonstrated rather widely in the 60s. Now, of course, most of you went to high school with some young teachers that are on the same side of the gap you're on. Here in the university, you have young instructors. You might even have a young professor. I'm not sure whether there are any professors under 29, but I don't know how your physics department runs. But mathematicians and physicists tend to reach their heights very early. So, and you got lots of, all the TAs are on your side of the gap now. And do you call them TAs? Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when we had the first strike of TAs at Madison. And this was the beginning of the new regime, because they weren't striking as students. They were striking as junior members of the faculty. And this was the beginning of a quite different world, in which there are lots of people out in the world doing different things who are on the same side of the generation gap as the students. But there are no teenagers anywhere in the world that are on the same side as the gap as their parents. And there are no parents of teenagers who are on the same side of the gap as their children. So it's the worst possible period to be a parent of a teenager or to be a teenager with parents. You know, and it isn't going to last. Now, some people don't realize this, of course, and you have small towns where they pass an ordinance, they'll never have a young teacher again. No teachers under 35. In 6 years, the generation gap will be at 35, and then they'll find what they've got. And 10 years from now, there will be lots of people who have teenage kids who are on the same side of the gap. So this is a really tough moment, exceedingly tough moment for everybody, because the degree of non-communication between children and parents is at its height. That is, it started at 65 and it went on. So as far as parents and kids are concerned, this is just as bad. But it isn't as far as teachers and young faculty, and you're planning to go to medical school, there are lots of young doctors are out now. You're planning to go to law school, there are lots of young lawyers. And so the burden that kids felt in 1966 and 67, that they had to fix the world in college, doesn't happen now anymore, because nobody in college thinks they have to fix the world. It didn't work anyway. And they gradually discovered that the way to fix the world is not to sit down in the dean's office. And I think that discovery reached its height when the President of the United States said he didn't care what any student thought. If they weren't going to vote for him, they weren't people. And that was it. And of course, if what you do has no effect on the people you're trying to influence, so the height of student influence was when the kids in the New Hampshire primary forced the abdication of Lyndon Johnson, and that's the greatest victory that kids ever had in the whole world, and was the biggest abdication the world's ever known. Because no one with the power that the President of the United States had ever abdicated before. And that was an abdication, because Johnson would have been elected. It would have been a bloody election, but he'd have been elected. And it was forced by young people. And we had beautiful pictures in the New York Times of lovely, blonde, open-faced youngsters. Big, a lot of them, and underneath it said, "Your children have come back to you." Well, they didn't stay very long in that principle. But starting with that point, students more began giving up the notion that college politics was the way to change the world. And they began going back in a great variety of ways. And it's necessary to realize why, and to realize that you're not sunk in apathy, that you haven't suddenly turned into mercenary characters, that the fact you were interested in things in the mid-1960s was not due to the Vietnam War. Now, that's one of the things that elders say all the time. See, oh, yes, they were very idealistic when they wanted to get out of the draft. The minute the draft disappeared, they didn't care about anything. There wasn't any draft in Britain. There wasn't any draft in France. They weren't in the Vietnam War. They were out of it then. Right around the world, we found exactly the same phenomenon. And, of course, people fussed about different things in different countries. But right around the world, we had an outbreak from young people at that point. So don't let people tell you that the only reason anybody was ever idealistic is because they wanted to get out of the draft. In other words, they weren't idealistic at all, because it isn't true. Now, you put that in context, and you get some context on what the media are saying about you, what some of your professors are saying about you. Oh, dear, this group of students, you know, they don't care about anything anymore. And put it all in context so that you realize where you are. There are a lot of disappointed late middle-aged characters around. We used to call the sideburn generation. You know, they didn't quite grow beards, and they didn't quite grow their hair long. They just let it creep down their cheeks. And who did a lot of identifying with young people for a period, and we had books like The Greening of America and stuff of that sort. It's important to realize this and put this in line. But then you have to go back to your parents' time, and what did they think about? What were they doing when they were your age? And that's well worthwhile looking at, too. And really go back and think over very carefully what people in this country had gone through. A long, long depression before World War I, in which there was tremendous misery and tremendous poverty in this country. Then World War I coming very suddenly, and for the first time, Americans going overseas in enormous numbers. The end of the war. Big Red Scare. We always have a Red Scare when there's a war. Right afterwards, Big Red Scare, chase everybody. And then a tremendous period of affluence and corruption. I went to the wedding, 50th wedding anniversary of one of my college friends, and that just coincided with the 50th anniversary of Teapot Dome. And so they had, and there were young lawyers, I mean old lawyers, sitting at my table who had been young at the time of the Harding administration. And they had a lot of songs, you know, you have your Watergate and we have our Teapot Dome. And then the lawyers said, you know, it's very interesting. They just went back to their class reunion. It was surprising how many of their friends' nephews were involved, or great-nephews were involved with Watergate, just as they'd been involved with Teapot Dome. On the right side, you understand, as prosecutors. So we had a period of corruption after World War I. We had a period of red baiting. We had a period of labor breaking. We had a period of corruption. We had a period of a car in every garage and a chicken in every pot. And everybody went and invested in the stock market. And we welched on the League of Nations after we'd proposed it. And we had got the whole world to end the war in terms of what we proposed. Then we came home and didn't do it. And prepared for World War II. And the day that we refused to join the League of Nations, World War II was sealed, virtually. But we went on a binge, and things were very affluent and very expensive, terribly awful inflation at that period, and great misery in the end of it when the banks failed. And then the banks failed. I came home from the field in late August 1929. All my friends were investing in the stock market, and I had $5,000. Now, that's about equivalent to having at least $25,000 a day. And you can imagine how you'd feel if you just had $25,000. I'd made $5,000 out of coming of age. It was in the bank, and they wanted me to invest it in the stock market at once. And I just was a little stubborn. I'd just gotten back, and I wasn't sure that this is what I wanted to do. And, of course, a month later, they all wanted to borrow the $5,000 to bail them out of the stock market. And then we went in for the long, terrible depression. Now, if you go back and find out where your grandparents were and where your parents were and where your professors were, you understand a lot of their prejudices. If you can find out where they were at these different periods. People postponed marriages. Only the very poor got married because it didn't make any difference. They were so poor anyway. And adding somebody lived with somewhere, and whether they were married or not didn't matter very much. And you hear a lot about the Depression having been very bad, and then we got over it. We did not get over it until World War II. There were 10 million people unemployed when World War II started in this country still. And then, of course, came World War II. And then your parents, roughly speaking, came back and went to college. And this was the first time that we'd had such an enormous number of people in college. Now, this is another thing you want to work out very carefully. After World War I, we invented the idea that everybody should go to high school. Before that, the only people that went to high school were kids that were going to go to college, which was a very small number, and a few commercial students. And we were already beginning to degrade the high schools. My parents say they learned Greek. My day, they learned Latin, and we were beginning to say, these people that are getting into high school, you know, you can't expect them to learn anything. And when after World War I we started putting everybody into high school, we promptly said, nobody can learn much. So we dropped second year algebra, and we dropped trig, and we dropped Latin, and then we dropped French and German. Finally, we dropped Spanish, and they don't learn any language, because by this time we know nobody can learn anything, which is the general effect of despising the people that you bring in. And the whole history of American education has been, on the one hand, we've been expansive, and we've said, we want everybody to have a high school education. Everybody should have a right to a high school education, which is true. But on the other hand, we'd said, those people, you know. Now, those people have changed. In the early 1920s, those people came from Southern Europe and couldn't learn anything. And we've got over that a long time ago. And in the 90s, of course, those people came from Ireland and couldn't learn anything. And we've steadily got over the notion of the people who couldn't learn anything. Now, that lovely baby, I love having babies in an audience, but when they cry, I think it's a good idea to take them away so they're happier. And that baby is not enjoying this lecture now. Mm-hmm. So that as we made high school universal, almost universal, we lowered the standards. And I'm sorry, because I love having babies in an audience. Lots of them. And as we took more and more people in, high school education got worse and worse. After World War II, we did the same thing with colleges. We said, now everybody who wants to go to college should have a chance to go to college. And institutions like this are the result. With a great faculty and a large number of people and beautiful buildings that sprang up all over the country because we were trying to set up a situation where everybody could go to college. And initially, in the 1940s, they made some very serious mistakes. We had all the GIs back at college, you know? And they were all living in trailers and going to school and working hard, and they felt they'd earned their right to go to college, and they were the best students that had ever been on a college campus, and the faculty thought it had something to do with sex. They thought it was because they were married they were good students. So they thought if they let all the students get married, they'd have all good students. And they found out it didn't work that way. And the GI group were a very different group than the ones that came along afterwards. And that group of kids on the college campus set the style for the 50s. They lived in trailers, and fathers got acquainted with their babies because the baby sat on their thesis, and they might as well. And they became fixated on babies. And in the early 1950s, it was the boys who had two jobs, not the girls. It was the boys who carried pictures of their children around in their pockets and showed them to me. And on Wall Street, talking about your children was substituted for hating Roosevelt. And everybody moved to the suburbs, got married as quickly as possible, got through college as quickly as possible, but worked perfectly hard at it, moved to the suburbs, bought a house that would take them 30 years to pay off, and set up the 50s. Now, most of your parents, very large numbers of them, hit just that period, who moved to the suburbs. Now, out here, instead of moving to the suburbs, they transformed agriculture until it became a business and ceased to be the family farm. And so there were almost as great transformations went on here as went on in the cities also. And I've ridden by farm after farm today, not a chicken anywhere, not a garden, nothing. The farms are factories where they're producing grain and absolutely nothing else and wrecking the soil while it's being done, putting in masses of nitrogen fertilizer that's going to run off to the rivers and complicate the world more. So that the changes that took place in the cities, and of course we wrecked our cities completely, because all these young people who wanted children more than anything else, who wanted security and children and to have a good life, all moved to the suburbs and left nobody in the cities to look after the cities. So the cities became the homes of the very rich and the very poor, the very old and the very young, and all the people that formed the backbone of a community had left. This all went on in the 50s. This all went on in the period when your parents were young. And it may be as hard to understand some of it as it was for the kids in the 50s to understand what it had been like in the 30s. And yet this is virtually the problem that we're confronting in our own society today. Unless you can understand what happened in the 50s and what happened in the 30s and what happened in the teens, unless you realize what your own parents and grandparents went through, you're going to find it very tough to understand the future and understand the world, because also you now are you're the post-energy crisis group, just as the kids about 5 years ago were the first kids that got really interested in the environment. And we had the environmental movement that spread all over the country. We saw the moon, the earth from the moon. Everybody got excited. The environmental movement was launched, and with a lot of good things were launched from the Stockholm conference on. And then right on top of that came the energy crisis, which many people think is the opposite. That is, you can't look after the environment because you're short of oil. And so now you're in the middle of a confrontation between the people who want to protect the environment and the people who think that if we don't have more oil, we can't possibly exist. And if we don't have enough oil, then we should have plutonium. So that you're in a new spot, and a spot that hasn't yet ripened completely. So for the people who leave this year, you may leave in as great a confusion as you came. But for the kids who are freshmen and sophomores, probably by the time you leave college, you're going to be facing some of these issues in a quite new way. And so what I want to majorly emphasize, and then we're going to have a few questions, is that you are facing an as new a world as the kids were in the 60s, and a world that has not yet taken much shape, where the major issues at present are we're going to have nuclear plants proliferated all over the world in a form that anybody can make a bomb. The mafia, a group of guerrillas, any country can make a bomb and threaten the rest of the world, and that we're dealing with our environment so wastefully that we can't possibly manage to sustain life on this planet if we go on. Now, this is, people are just beginning to worry about, really worry, and really begin to think of how we're going to take the next step to defending life on this planet, which is the one time when human beings are interested in real issues and care about them, is when the thing they care about is endangered and when there's hope. And so the problems you're going to be having to deal with is there's danger, all great danger to the life that we and our ancestors have lived, but there also is great hope, because for the first time the dangers are not on the ground or in the sea but in the air, and we all share the same air. And what is good for us is good for other people, and what's good for other people is good for us. And we're not over against other countries as we once were, but Canada and Mexico and the United States share the same air, and pollution goes back and forth through the air, and if we don't take care of our pollution, we poison them, and if they don't take care of theirs, they poison us. So we have an opportunity to build one world with shared air, with air cities taking the role that once seaports once took. And we have the physical conditions, thanks to all the inventions we've made and all the trouble that have come out of the inventions. We have the physical conditions to build a genuinely planetary community where we may be able to save this planet and build a life on it that's worth living.
Margaret Mead, in an address recorded in April at Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois. In the question and answer session after the address, one member of the audience wanted to know where Dr. Mead thought the women's movement is going.
Well, I hope it's going to go somewhere where it's concerned with what's happening to this country as a whole. the trouble with the present women's movement, I think it's been too narrow. Now, it's gone along with all the other groups who only find out what's wrong with their rights and don't worry about anyone else. And so we've had every group of people from left-handed to redheads in the country who could form a group and say they were badly treated. And they have been. There's everybody in this country is badly treated, even Republicans. So what we need is the kind of women's movement that we had in the past, where women were working for initially for the abolition of slavery, for better international relations, for the well-being of children, and all the things they used to work for. Now, the present women's movement has been, on the whole, too narrow, I think. Otherwise, it's just picked up where it left off 50 years ago when women all went home, crawled into caves and stayed there, and they've just come out.
Dr. Mead was then asked if she had changed her views on a trial period in marriage.
No, I never advocated trial marriage. That's what my enemies say. You know, everybody is known by what their enemies say about them in the end. Nobody has any position. You know, most people think Freud said the world was run by sex. He didn't, but that's what they think. I never advocated trial marriage. I don't think you can try marriage. The great point about marriage is you're stuck with it and everybody knows it, you know? So everybody you see knows you're married and you have to go home to find your clothes. And how can you try it? Because if you're trying it, you're not stuck with it. What you can try is parenthood. You see, you can borrow a baby for the weekend and see what happens. Then, if that works better, you can borrow one for 2 months and see what happens before you make up your mind. And what I advocated was that young people who didn't intend to have children yet, because they were students or middle-aged people that already had children, enough children and were remarrying, should have one kind of a license and one kind of a commitment and one kind of a religious ceremony. And that when they were preparing to be parents, they should have another. And they shouldn't be preparing to be parents unless they knew they could be parents. And good ones. Now remember, in the 50s, and this was going on up to the 60s when I wrote that first article, which was in 66, I think, everybody in this country was still getting married and having children and getting pregnant to get married. You know, we think of that period as being immoral. It was the most moral period we ever had, because from some people's standpoint, because all they wanted was marriage. And the kids got pregnant to get married, to force their parents to finance the wedding, to force them to let them get married and support them through college. Well, the next stage that we moved into, as having so many children became unpopular and so forth, and an arrangement, we now have substantially what I talked about, except that everybody insists it isn't a marriage. They still believe that if you call it a marriage, you've somehow got somebody hooked. And there's still a lot of girls who would like to think that if they call it a marriage, the men will stay. They're totally mistaken, but that's what they think. So what I advocated was that people could have one license that says you can live together with the blessing of the dean of women and anybody you like. The church, if you want to be blessed by the church, which says we are not planning to have children yet. And a second license when you said, we're ready to have children. At that point, you bring in the relatives, because they may have to look after them, you know.
The next questioner wanted to know if Dr. Mead saw continued upgrowth in our culture.
Well, we have got to the point, and we have finally realized, you know, that you can't grow forever. This country was living under the delusion that all you had to do was to go up, 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 up forever. And they didn't notice that the supplies were finite on this planet, the capacity to absorb waste and pollution was finite. And we've certainly got to a point where we've got to stop depending on material growth to make a good society. But, you know, it doesn't mean we have to stop growing. And it's fascinating how all this, none of the good things pollute. You know, love doesn't pollute, prayer doesn't pollute, song doesn't pollute, but war pollutes, and crime pollutes, and slums pollute, and horrible old cars that emit all sorts of emissions pollute, and so that we're not, when we talk about growth, it depends on what growth. We've got to stop this ridiculous nonsense that you just run the GNP up forever. And, you know, if you made any kind of extrapolation, we were going to have 2 million psychologists soon. What did anybody do with them? Any occupation we took was going to grow, and pretty soon you get unemployment in it. So that I think that we're beginning to realize that all limits of growth mean that you don't grow that way, you grow another way. You grow qualitatively instead of quantitatively and build a better life instead of just piling up more things all the time, using up more resources. At present, we're this little tiny section of the Earth's population. About 6% of the Earth's population are using up 40% of the irreplaceable resources of this planet, destroying them, throwing them away. The latest thing they've thought to do now is to can tea. So now you can buy, you can go to all the trouble of making a thing like a beer can, mining the material, putting up a plant, making those cans that are non-biodegradable, and put tea in it and sell it. You know, now that is the final imbecility. We've lost the possibility of making tea.
Dr. Mead was then asked what kinds of change politically she saw occurring in the future of the country.
Well, I think all our political systems are out of date. They're all of them free electronic, you know. They're all back in the days of the first law of thermodynamics. And when you talked about forces and labor, what labor contributed and all this stuff, you know, they're all out of date. Marxism is just as out of date as free enterprise. They all belong back a long time ago. And we're going to have to develop a new kind of political system. Now, there are a lot of people in this country think it would save thinking if they could just copy someone else, you know. So in the 20s, we were going to have the same system the Russians had. And all the enthusiasts went over and looked it up and admired it. Now we look at China. And China may be the answer. Now, whatever China is, it's not the answer to the United States. You know, China is a way of getting out of one very, very ancient economy and taking advantage and jumping over all the stages that we've been in to get to a different stage. But we're in those stages. We can't jump the same way. And if we invent more localized, small economy, if we for once grow the food where you are, do you know that all the milk drunk in Atlanta comes from Wisconsin? Why in the world should all the milk that people drink in Atlanta be taken to from Wisconsin every night? You know, they could have cows near Atlanta. That sort of thing we're going to have to change, maybe. But we're not going to have a system like China. We're not going to have a system like the Soviet Union. But we're going to have to invent something new. And it's going to have to be really new and different and fit the state of the world. We have to work and invent a new one.
Dr. Mead was asked to comment on the views of pessimists who did not share her optimistic view of the future.
Well, whether people see a dim view or not is probably nothing but a matter of temperament, because there's plenty of data to prove both positions, plenty of them. Now, I happen to be an optimist, or I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be wasting my time going around lecturing people if I believed that we had 10 years more on this planet and then doomsday. What would one do it for? I believe that what we know at present, no man, the most brilliant man or woman that's ever lived, has used more than 10% of their existing brains. All right, we've got 9/10, and most people have a lot more to use, so we don't need to despair of human brains. I've seen people come in one generation from the Stone Age to the present. I've lived in places where a kid in school says, my father was a cannibal, I'm going to be a doctor. And he is. I've seen people coming out of the Stone Age who are now studying general systems theory and are chancellors of the universities and things of this sort. So, of course, I believe we can do it. I mean, if people in New Guinea can skip 10,000 years, we might be able to get 10 years ahead.
The last questioner said he thought he detected a kind of nostalgia in Dr. Mead's remarks about the days of the small-scale family farm as opposed to corporate agriculture. He asked her, would a return to small-scale farming solve the future problem of feeding an ever-growing population?
No return to anything ever solves anything. And that's, nobody's proposing that we return to anything. When we started feeding our children on self-demand, we were not being primitive. We weren't doing what the primitive mother did when she wore the baby around her neck and fed him when he cried. We used clocks. We wrote in pencil and paper, and we wrote down when the baby was hungry and built a schedule. We weren't being primitive, but we were giving the child something that we hadn't been giving them before. Now, one of the things we've got to do is to localize food production and not use up all the energy in the world. First, contaminating it so it will keep with every kind of poison we can think up, using lots of energy to do it, then using a lot more energy to pack it till it's burglar-proof, then shipping it two or three times around the world. Now, this is not the way to manage the food shortage, and so we will certainly have to localize food production more. And we're beginning to move towards it. I just read the figures. There are now 35 million family gardens in this country, and that's all grown up in the last 3 or 4 years, where people are growing their own vegetables somewhere instead of reading something that's being Burbanked till it has no taste and no shape and no nourishment, machine-picked, uniform size, looking nice with no value whatsoever in it, which is what we've been doing with food. Now, things like that are going to happen, but we're not going to return to the family farm. We're not going to return to the extended family. We're going to build communities that are elective instead of biological. You know, and the old village, you were stuck with those people. You've been stuck with them for 1,000 years, and they all knew who you were and who your grandfather was and what you were likely to be. We're not going back to that, but we're going to build communities where if you don't like your grandmother, get somebody else's, you know, but get one.
Anthropologist Margaret Mead, speaking at Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois, in April of this year. Her remarks were recorded by public station WCBU, Peoria, Illinois. The field producer was WCBU's Roger Dobrik, with technical assistance by Larry Kohlberg. Funds for Options are provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For Options, I'm Mike Waters. And this is NPR, National Public Radio.